At the same time, permit you to turn your TV set down. This won't work if your TV set is blaring away. So I'm available to respond to questions that you may have. If we've got a battery of people sitting over here who will take the questions and then put them on the line. This telephone device, if the cameraman could turn the camera back a little bit so you can see the device in front of me. Focus on that, right. This is a telephone device with a receiver here. It's attached to the microphones, and it's attached over here on the table on the side to three telephones. And so I won't have to hold a receiver in my hand. If you want to ask a question, then wait for an answer or get involved somewhat, just hang on to the line, and we'll try and do it that way. Obviously, in the interest of time, we won't be able to get into a roundhouse argument and deny other people the opportunity of calling in. We want to try and be as fair as possible and try and take as many questions as possible in the allotted time. If this is a successful way of doing it, because you can imagine there's not enough time in the campaign period between now and August and then again in November to meet each and every citizen. But I think it's important to make oneself available and accountable, because I have been serving you for the last 5.5 years. I think we have a question. Let's put it on and see how this thing works.
Can you turn the mic now?
Yes.
Would you please let me know where our new federal building is going to be located here in Anchorage?
The federal building is supposed to have been announced, or will be announced tomorrow or the day after, sometime this week. It will be announced out of Washington by the GSA. They'll announce the location. The location will be the one chosen by the City Council. If you recall last year when I secured the federal building, I promised that I would use my office as chairman of the Subcommittee on Buildings and Grounds to guarantee that the decision would be made locally. And that's just what was done, and the GSA will follow local recommendations. The key area will be the corner of C Street and 9th Avenue, which was the first choice by the representatives of the people of Anchorage. Next one.
Senator Cavell?
Please.
Yes, is it true that in your book, Citizen Power, that you talk about government ownership of corporations and admit that you called for the and sponsored, as a matter of fact, the National Environmental Protection Act, which caused the delay in the pipeline? And then I notice in your announcement that you claim credit for getting the pipeline built. Isn't that somewhat inconsistent?
Well, I don't know if anybody in Alaska that disputes the fact that it was my amendment, which initially was unpopular, that I was able to bring through the Senate that brought about the Alaska pipeline today. And so I think I can properly take credit for that, and no one that I know disputes that.
Isn't it true, though, that you were the one who, that you co-sponsored the National Environmental Protection Act that caused the delay in the first place?
Well, not only that, I not only co-sponsored, I co-authored it and still think it's a good piece of legislation.
But
I see nothing wrong with studying an activity that the government will be party to before we do it, before we undertake it. It just makes good sense.
But it did cause a delay, didn't it?
There's no question it caused a delay, and of course, I think the delay was excessive, and it was the president of Union Oil, Mr. Fred Hartley, who was the first to say that had they gone ahead and built it without the study that was made, that we would have probably made some mistakes.
Well, I don't want to take up your time, but it just seemed kind of inconsistent to me that we, that you would try to take credit for the pipeline, and then be the person who co-sponsored and, as you said, co-authored the bill that that caused the delay in the first place. And as according to your book, you knowingly admit that this would have caused a delay.
Well, of course, I didn't put that in the book. That wasn't the case at the time. So I think you're reading into the book, much like you just attributed in the book, that I'm for the government taking over corporations. I submit, sir, you can't read very well, because go back to the book and you'll find out that it's just the opposite. I try in Citizen Power to talk of a system of diffusing power through constituencies so that the individual citizen can have more to say, not greater government. And in fact, I've tried to, and now very strongly, to cut down the size of government, because I think in many areas it's much, much too excessive.
Yeah. Well, I just I noticed in the book that you just called for a federal chartering of corporations, which would seem...
Oh, that's a good deal different now. Federal chartering, we have state chartering. And the reason why I call for federal chartering is so that the citizen can have more access as to what's going on in corporate activity, because you have one corporation going to the state of Delaware because the taxes are better, and you have states competing within themselves. I think this hurts the states in question, and I don't think it's in the best interest of interstate commerce. And since these corporations operate in interstate commerce, there's no reason why they shouldn't be responsible to an interstate system, which of course would be the federal system.
Well, I don't want to take your time, but I disagree with you, but thank you.
Well, I appreciate your call, and I think we were both entitled to disagree with each other. Next question.
Hello?
Please.
Hello?
Yes, I can hear you. And
can I ask my question now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Has anything been done to break up this, I guess it's called vertical monopoly of the oil companies who control the filling stations, the refineries, and produce the oil? Anything been done to break that up?
No, not at this point in time.
Why?
Well, I think that eventually legislation may come about. This is all trust-busting activity. And I would hope that a study could be made to make a determination in this regard. I do know that from my point of view, I don't know as busting it up would add any drop of oil. What we need to have more oil is to have more capital, more money spent on that activity. So busting up the oil companies won't necessarily do that, but providing the capital will do that. Another question?
Hi, Governor.
Hello. Hello, could you speak a little louder?
Yes, sir. Senator, this is Ed Hill, and I understand that there is a proposition in front of Congress now to extend the veterans benefits for education, which expired this month. Do you have anything on this at this time?
I support that proposition very, very much. In fact, I would not have received a college degree had it not been for the GI Bill that I received. And I can't think of anything I really feel that we should pay the cost of education from kindergarten all the way up to a PhD. But we haven't been able to get through that kind of legislation. But in the absence of that, I think that we have every right to use as a vehicle the special treatment that we do give our veterans, young men who have given of their time at a very crucial part in their lives to the service of their government. I support that legislation very strongly, and I'm very optimistic that we'll see something come out of the Congress, not only in terms of educational benefits for the veterans of the Vietnam War, but also loan benefits, the business benefits, and housing benefits. Next.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm concerned about the income tax situation in this country, and how come the little person, income-wise, of this country has to bear the burden of the income tax situation, which I feel a lot of the money is squandered in the first place. And why doesn't Congress try and do something about these inadequacies? They seem to get worse and worse as time goes by.
I couldn't agree more. In fact, it's one of the very frustrating activities of a senator to see something wrong and to try and do something about it. And as you recall, that young man earlier was quoting a book, Citizen Power, that I wrote. And I understand that many John Birchers are taking that book to task. They can have at it, as far as I'm concerned. But one of the items in that book that I try to handle is a tax reform package and the creation of a single tax so that we can broaden the tax base to people of larger incomes. You see a classic situation where President Nixon winds up probably paying for the years in question less tax, certainly, than I did, and I'm probably less tax than you did for the years 70, 71, and 72. Of course, he's now paid up his taxes, but laws that permit that to take place are wrong. Not only are the laws wrong in that regard, but the tax code is about shoulder height for myself. And that's obviously so complex that the average citizen cannot understand it. And so I would hope that we could begin to effect a reform in our system of taxation where we don't use our system of revenue to do a whole bunch of things, that we do it to do only one thing, and that is raise revenue and in that process, do it equitably. And I can assure you that since I've now been placed on the Finance Committee where taxes emanate from, that I'll work everything in my power to bring about tax reform, and that is to make those who have the incomes carry a greater burden and the people at the bottom of the spectrum less of a burden.
Now, Senator Gravatt,
please.
I would like to ask you now about the your stand on the Occupational Safety and Health Administration Act there, and in view of the fact that it is a law that's capable of putting small businesses out of business or in a serious bind. Now, I understand that that there is a law that states or a regulation that small businesses are eligible for assistance from SBA and so on. Is that money, does that have to be paid back, or what is the status of that? And also, what is your status on the overall act? I understand there's about 70 co-sponsors on a, not that many, but about 29, I think, co-sponsors on a bill by Representative Sims to repeal the OSHA Act.
Well, first off, I'm not in the House, I'm in the Senate, so I wouldn't focus on the Sims bill until it did pass the House. I voted for it when it passed the Senate. I was not on the Senate committee that worked on it, so I did not have a role in the mechanics of it. Of course, the Congress is very much of a committee system. The reason why I voted for it was because of a concern that I have for safety on the job. Now, I know, as you know, that that law has traveled a great distance. And of course, the largest part of that law were the regulations that were written by the bureaucratic community as to its implementation. And certainly in some of these regulations, there have been some excesses that will now probably warrant a change to some degree in the law, since we will have developed some experience. And I will undoubtedly vote for some changes in that law. I don't know as I would vote for the repeal of it, unless somebody could make a very convincing case to me, because I still think it's very, very necessary to have some standards of safety in the workplace, because there's nothing can be more cruel than the workman being at the under the control of the manager, and of course suffer from some inadequacies of safety. Now, you're right, and it probably is the case where in small businesses some of these rules can be unreasonable and unreasonably enforced. But I think that with the experience that we'll acquire in this, that the Congress can refocus on the problem and try and do something more constructive and not only help the larger business enterprises in affecting safety, but also consider the problems of the small business enterprises. Another question?
Senator Gravatt?
Please.
What?
Please go ahead. Could you speak a little louder?
Are you in favor of impeaching President Nixon?
Well, I just wonder if the audience can hear the questions when they're speaking low like that. She was asking if I'm in favor of impeaching President Nixon. I'll be acting as a juror if and when impeachment gets to the United States Senate. And it would be grossly unfair to me as a juror to, one, arrive at a preconceived notion as to what I'll do, and two, to make that notion announce that publicly. I think that'd be unfair. I would hope that regardless of my partisan bias, because I'm a Democrat and Richard Nixon's a Republican, regardless of that partisan situation, I'd hope that I'd have the moral turpitude to listen to the facts, study them, and make a moral judgment that would be in the best interest of the people of this country. Next question.
Hello, Mr. Levant.
Hello.
Yeah, so, well, this is a question concerning the Gun Control Act, and specifically in relation to the ever-increasing bid to not only take away our handguns, but our rifles and shotguns. How do you feel on this?
Very much opposed to that, and I voted very strongly against that in the Congress. In fact, last weekend I was in Anchorage attending the gun show, and we had set up a booth with a petition to get signatures of people here in Alaska to support me in opposing gun control of any kind. When that petition is completed, I'll take that petition and give it to the chairman of the Government Operations Committee, where most of the legislation in this regard lies. I think it would be a very serious mistake, and I can only say that my reasons are philosophical reasons. I think it's very important for a free people to have access and to be able to bear arms as free citizens. And I can assure you that as long as I'm in public office, I'll oppose it with every ounce and skill and every bit of ability that I have. Next question.
Okay, Senator Gravel.
Please.
Yeah. Senator Gravel?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, I would like to have you account for your poor voting record in Congress.
I've been in the Congress 5.5 years, and during that period of time, I have been in voting 2/3 of the time, been absent about 1/3 of the time. Some people find this reason for criticism. I doubt that if I am reelected, that my attendance will go appreciably higher than that, mainly because of the style that I use in representing you in Washington. The Congress is a committee system, and most of the important things that happen in the Congress happen in committee. Let me give you an example. When the highway bill this year passed the Congress, I was on a plane coming to Alaska. Now, I could have stayed in Washington and voted on that highway bill. That highway bill had $58 million for the pavement of the Alcan Highway, had set up a $10 million fund for bicycle paths. This was a fund nationally that I had authored for bicycle paths, boardwalks, and trails. Had set up another $10 million for Indian native highways that could be done. And of course, that same legislation had the continued $20 million extra money for Alaska. Now, I was able to get all of that, and it wasn't anybody else, because I'm the only Alaskan that serves on the Public Works Committee and on the Subcommittee for Highways. This was all done within my subcommittee. This was all done within the Public Works Committee. And so when it came to the floor, the vote was over 75 to around 10 or 12. Now, I could have stayed there and made it 76. I felt it was more important to come to Alaska. Now, earlier this year, I went down to Louisiana and held a hearing for Russell Law and Bennett Johnston. Now, I didn't have to go to Louisiana or New Orleans, and probably you Alaskans could say, well, what's Mike Gravel doing down in New Orleans? What's he doing in Los Angeles when we hear over the AP that he's made a speech or a statement or held hearings in Los Angeles? Well, I'm learning about the problems of Los Angeles, and I'm learning about the problems of New Orleans. Because when I come back to the Senate, and when I act as in my capacity as chairman of the Water Resources Subcommittee, I have to pass on things that affect New Orleans, Los Angeles, New York, Long Island, all of those areas. And if I'm going to do that job intelligently and fairly for the representatives of that area, I have to go there. Now, when I went there, I missed votes on the Senate floor. And when we want senators to come to Alaska, they miss votes for their state while they're here in Alaska, visiting Alaska and learning about our problems. But I think that's an important part of the process, because I'm going to have to go to Bennett Johnston and ask him to vote for the Alaska pipeline, as I did, and he voted with us. And the same thing with Russell Law. And I'm going to obviously have to ask for their support when it comes to the land problem we have in Alaska. So you can't be at two places at once. Right here today, I'm in Alaska to announce my candidacy for re-election. The Senate was in session today, and they were voting. They were voting on issues. Now, you would not be able to ask me this question this evening if I had been in the Senate today voting. It's just impossible for me to be in two places at once. And, of course, Alaska is very far away. It's 5,000 miles. Whenever we have a very important vote, and I'm in Alaska, I travel that distance back there to make that vote, and many times round robin back here. So sometimes these votes, when they're important for Alaska, cost 10,000 miles. It's painful, but that's part of the process. I'm not complaining, but I do hope that there will be understanding on this issue of attendance. And I hope that it'll be understood that not all of the answers, not all of the issues are solved on the Senate floor. I think the best comparison I can make is, when is it most important to have the doctor? Is it important to have him at the operation, or to have him when you're discharged from the hospital? I'll try to be there whether it's here in Alaska or in Washington, D.C., when it's time for the operation. Thank you.
Senator Bobella.
Please.
This is Mrs. Joyce Moe from Kodiak.
Please.
I'd like to thank you for the help you've shown me and my family, and also other families of the Coast Guard over there. Now, my question is there anything being done about extending the mile limit for fishermen from other countries?
Yes, as you know, we have a bill for the 200-mile limit. I'm a co-author of that bill, along with Senator Magnuson and my colleague in the Senate. We've had recent hearings on it in Alaska. I'm hopeful that that legislation can pass the Congress, and that will give us a 200-mile limit, plus a species approach that will be law until the Law of the Sea Conference arrives at a similar decision. What I am disturbed about is that a month and a half ago, I called upon the administration to say whether or not, if the Congress passed that legislation, that they would uphold the law. I have not been able to get a response out of the White House, and the response out of the State Department indicated that they would not. Now, I'd hate to see us fight, work our hearts out to get this legislation, and to see a situation where the law is not implemented. And so I would hope that we could bring pressure on the White House to back us up when and if we can get that law passed. That's one of the approaches. Obviously, it's the only sound approach that we can undertake. There's another aspect of the problem, and I'm in the process of researching it, and that is that we have a law on the books which says that if a nation violates a treaty, that we can sort of embargo their products from coming into this country. We're doing research as to finding out whether or not these fishing vessel violations constitute a violation under existing treaties. If that's the case, I'll use every ounce of my power to cause the administration, to force the administration to implement existing law to punish foreigners who do not adhere to the same conservation practices as we do. And thank you very much for your kind words about the Coast Guard, our efforts in that regard. Please.
My question refers to the document that's referred to as the Pentagon Papers. It's sort of a two-part question. Number one, why did you decide to read the Pentagon Papers or enter them into the public record? And the second part is, why did you decide to do that at such a seemingly inopportune time or an unusual time as 12 midnight?
Well, the first part of the question was that once I came into possession of the Pentagon Papers, I realized that all it was an historical description of over a 20-year period as to how this country got into the Vietnam War. The motivation was by the people in the Pentagon that they wanted to know what went wrong. Well, I felt if it was important for the generals and the admirals to know what went wrong, it's a downside more important for the American people to know what went wrong, because the people in this country are supposed to be the boss. And so it's very simply, I gave information in releasing the Pentagon Papers to the American people, information and knowledge. I felt they had a right that they deserve to know. Now, why I did it at 12 midnight, obviously, in looking back, there are a lot of things that I could have done differently in that regard. But you must keep in mind that I had no knowledge, nor did anybody else in the country, as to the definition, the interrelationship of the laws of secrecy and what could and could not be done. I didn't know at the time, really, if I was breaking the law. I subsequently found out through a great deal of research and going all the way to the Supreme Court that I broke no laws, and I broke no rules of the Senate. It was not my intention to break any laws or to break any rules. I just felt it was important to inform the people. Why at 12 o'clock at night? I tried to read the Pentagon Papers on the floor of the United States Senate starting at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, which would have been normal. I was stopped from doing this by the Republican whip of the Senate, Robert Griffin, and I was thwarted at every step of the way until at 9 o'clock in the evening, through research by my staff, I only had one recourse, and that was I could use my prerogatives as chairman of a subcommittee and hold a hearing. And that's what I did. I recessed the Senate at that time, 9:15, and went to a committee room and held a hearing on the need for public buildings in this country. And the basis of this public buildings hearing is very simple. We had not built any public buildings in the United States for 10 years because we didn't have the money to do the job, because we were squandering the money in Southeast Asia. And so I felt it was important to place in the record of that subcommittee the information as to what caused us to squander all of that money. And I read until about 12 o'clock, 12:30, and at that point in time, under the rules of the Senate, I have placed into the record all of the papers, which would have taken many, many hours to read. I placed them in a record, the public record at that point in time, and then adjourned the subcommittee, and from thence forward, the Pentagon Papers were part of public domain. They belong to you, an American citizen. They belong to all Americans, the people who paid for that study, and the people who had a right to know what that study contained. Before you take the next call, I'd like to... it's very warm here in the studio, and if I were sitting in your living room, I'd be doing the same thing, and I think you'd permit me that courtesy to at least be a little more comfortable. Please, next question.
Yes, Senator Gravel?
Please.
My question is regarding the current policies of the Forest Service regarding their timberlands that are sold to private timber companies. What I would like to know is what your opinion is on resolving the question of decreasing softwood lumber stock versus the environmentalist desire to preserve a certain amount of forest lands for multiple use.
Well, I think the major vehicle to do that, unless we go to some basic policy changes, of course, through the NEPA statements, and as a person earlier in the program pointed out, I was one of the co-authors of the National Environmental Protection Act. And what that means is before sales can take place, and even the ruling has been made before the implementation of existing sales, that a study must be made so that a determination can be made by the Forest Service as to whether or not we are depleting excessively a renewable resource. And I, as anybody else, would have to rely upon the technical expertise of that study before getting involved beyond that. So that there's a balance that has to take place. I think we have to rely upon the good public servants that we have in the Forestry Department and other departments of our government who inform us as elected officials and who, of course, work with you as citizens in this regard. So I would hope that the device that we have on the books, the NEPA statements, the studies that are made before the facts, before it's undertaken, will prove adequate in this regard. And of course, we will have public hearings as part of this process where citizens like yourself, if they're unhappy, can have put in, so to speak, their two cents. Now, if you have something specific in this regard that I haven't touched on, I'd be happy to hear your views, either by me, call me, or drop me a line, and I can try and expand upon it to you, or take your views and try and do something about changing policy. Please. Next question.
Hello,
I can't.
Senator?
Could she speak a little louder?
Yes, Senator?
Please.
Yes, I'm concerned about a certain bill that is before the House, and this is Senate Bill 3657, and this is in regards to the...
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Yes, this is in regards to eliminating all contributions to churches and schools, hospitals, charitable organizations, and so forth as deductible on their federal income tax returns. And I'd like to know what the logic is behind this, because to me it would be better taxation, or actually discouraging contributions to organizations that are really the lifeline of Americans.
Well, I don't... If it's a Senate bill in the House, it means that it's passed the Senate. And I'm on the Finance Committee, and I can assure you that there's no bill that's passed the Senate in this Congress that outlaws charitable contributions, because it would have passed through the committee on which I serve. And I do not take that view to outlaw that, and I know that it has not passed the Senate. Now, it may be, and you may have it confused, there may be a bill introduced in the House that has not got to the Senate yet, but I can assure you that I believe in the right of people to donate money to their churches, to their charities, to foundations. I don't think that the government's the only way to do things in our society. And as a person pointed out in the book Citizen Power that I wrote, I've gone to great lengths to define why this should be done by free citizens in a free society. So one, it has not passed the Senate. Two, I can assure you that I would oppose that kind of legislation if it's attempted in the Senate. Next question. can't hear you.
Oh, Senator?
Yes?
Yes, I was wondering, some of the other congressmen were interested in the military losing their cost of living allowance. Part of it within Alaska, in different areas. Also, we had some problem with perhaps that we'll be losing different jobs up here if some of them do move out.
Well, I must confess, I'm a little hurt when you say some congressmen other than myself. I am just as concerned about this problem, have spoken out on the problem, have issued press releases, spoken on the floor, and obviously you weren't aware of my efforts in that regard. That's just the fault of communications in our society. I'm deeply concerned. I think it's wrong. And I've opposed many of the policies that the Defense Department has had with respect to Alaska, in cutting back troops, in cutting back the cost of living, and in going to contracting to do a lot of the activities that properly should be done by permanent civil servants. I don't know how to fight this problem other than to continue my efforts to make government more open, less secrecy. This is a great ploy of the Defense Department that they want to do something to keep us out of it. They spring it on us overnight, and you're faced with a fait accompli. That's exactly what happened with the cost of living for the military. Bam, I woke up, and you found out, and I found out exactly the same time what they were going to do. Now, I don't think it's a fair way to treat a senator. I don't think it's a fair way to treat you without having a hearing before the fact so that you can have some input and so that I, as your elected official, can have some input. But that's been the very arrogant way that many of these decisions have been made by the Defense Department. I oppose it. I think it's wrong. A lot of times when they're cutting back on forces here in Alaska, they're expanding forces in other countries. And it's costing you more as a taxpayer, and of course you don't have the same security. We can defend any place in the United States and in the world right here from Alaska. This is the best strategic location that there exists in the world, and it's been underutilized in present military thinking. The only thing left for me to do is take a mallet and go knock some of those guys on the head and say, hey, you're doing it wrong. I'll continue trying in these efforts, and I hope that I'll be able to communicate my efforts in this regard a little better to you so that you won't have to admonish me again by saying, well, other people, and asking me what I'm doing. Next question.
Good evening, Senator Gravel.
Good evening. Thank you
for calling. A lot of people have been taking pot shots at you because of your decision to leave the Interior Committee for the Finance Committee. I'm sure there must be a good reason, but we never hear any of the good things about you, thanks to the Daily Times, etc. Could you let us know what the reason was for that change?
Very much so. The most powerful committee in the United States Senate is the Finance Committee. It's the same committee in the House that's the Ways and Means Committee. It's chaired by Wilbur Mills. From the day I got to Washington as your senator, I tried to get on the Finance Committee. It took me 4 years, and I mean it took some real difficult lobbying. So the day that I got on the Finance Committee, I thought that, boy, the people back in Alaska are just going to be happy that I've been able to get on an important committee so that I can be more effective for their problems.
Horse
lo and behold, I read in the newspapers, and I've been castigated ever since that I did the wrong thing getting off the Interior Committee and getting on the Finance Committee. You can imagine the frustration of being faced with that kind of criticism. I think it's a problem that when we were a territory, the important committee for us was the Interior Committee. Just as today, for Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, Micronesia, it's the important committee is the Interior Committee. But when it comes to the total power base, the activities that take place in the Congress, the Interior Committee is not all that important. In point of fact, most of the junior members of the Senate go on the Interior Committee. And when I hear people who are running for office saying that if I get elected senator, boy, I got it wired that I'll get on the Interior Committee. I've got it wired with the leadership. I got news for them. They don't have to get it wired, because any new person getting elected to the Senate, regardless of who he is going to be placed on the Interior Committee with the rest of the freshmen, because that's what happens to new members. Now let's compare really the power of the Interior Committee and my role in this regard. The pipeline last spring came up. It came out of the Interior Committee, and I wasn't on that committee. I was on a Finance Committee. But I was able to take an amendment, introduce it on the floor of the Senate. I had introduced an amendment, and it went to committee. But Scoop Jackson, the chairman of that committee, wouldn't let the amendment out. And so I could have been as a member of that committee and pounded on the committee table from now till doomsday, and that amendment still would not have got out of committee. So it wouldn't have made any difference if I was on a committee or not. But because I was on the finance committee and had an energy position and a staff to do research, which I didn't have when I was on the Interior Committee, I was able to equip myself in a better fashion to fight Scoop Jackson, not in committee, but on the floor of the United States Senate. Now, we won that fight. And we didn't win it because I was a member of the Interior Committee. We won it because I was a member of the Finance Committee. Now, the same thing will be true with the land grab of the Nixon administration that will affect Alaskans so much. I won't be on the Interior Committee, but I'm going to introduce a bill, an Alaskan bill. And we'll have hearings in Alaska before I introduce the bill. That bill will go to committee, and we'll get hearings. The Senate rules provide for this. We'll get hearings on that bill. And if that bill comes out of committee the wrong way, we'll introduce a bill on the floor of the United States Senate, and we'll fight the problem there. Let's look at the Finance Committee and see what comes out of the Finance Committee. The Finance Committee truly appropriates almost two-thirds of the federal budget. Now, appropriates. That's not in the Appropriations Committee. It comes out of the Finance Committee. Last year, we raised Social Security by 11%. That came through on the committee that I served, and I had a hand in the debate of that Social Security increase. I'd like to see Social Security be tied to cost of living, and I'll have a role in that on the Finance Committee. All health care legislation, Medicare, Medicaid, comes through the Finance Committee. All trade legislation. Alaska has more of its gross product in trade than any other state in the Union. All of that is affected by the Finance Committee. Taxation, energy policy with respect to taxation. In fact, I'm chairman of the Subcommittee on Energy in the Finance Committee. What's more important to the state of Alaska than tax policy and energy policy? I now have a leadership role in that regard. I don't know how any person who's informed could make the charge against me that I made the wrong decision by going from Interior to Finance, because Alaska's destiny obviously rests more importantly with the Finance than with the Interior Committee. I hope the people of this state will understand what I've tried to do in improving, not my position, Alaska's position, because that's who I work for, you Alaskans. Next question.
Good evening, Senator.
Good evening.
On the question of the capital move, this is the third time since statehood that we've been faced with the question of the relocation of the capital for the state of Alaska. In view of the tremendous needs, the tremendous cost involved in a capital move, and the other problems that are found inherent in that kind of plan, what is your position on the capital move?
I am against the capital move, and in making a speech in Juneau, I was reported out of context, and a lot of my friends got angry in the Anchorage area, some of whom were for the capital move. And that was, out of context, was that I called people that are for the capital move idiots. That's not so. I didn't say that. I have espoused views sometimes which people think are idiotic. That doesn't make me an idiot. I'm against the capital move, and I think I detected the way you phrased the question that you are also. And I think I'm against the capital move for the same reason that you are. That is that we've got so many priorities in this state of ours that we don't have the spare money to go out and go about moving the capital. And I don't think it makes sense to take money that we need for education, and we're not meeting our educational responsibility to our citizens in the state, to take money for health care, and we're not meeting that responsibility, to take money for housing, to take money for transportation, for communication. We could have the finest communication system in the entire world if we were willing and had the money to spend. So why talk and spending the money to build buildings and other places, money that could be spent to improve the quality of life in Alaska? So that's the prime reason why I'm against moving the capital. The second one's a very simple human reason. That is, I don't want to hurt many of the people who live in Juneau. If we move the capital out of Juneau, we'll make a ghost town out of Juneau. And there are Alaskans like you and I that have worked and saved all of their lives to acquire equities and houses, who have mortgages to pay off, who have their savings that would be just wiped out overnight if we pulled out the industry of government out of Juneau. I think we can make the community of Juneau accessible to all, and I think we have made it accessible to all, and I think with better communications, better transportation, that it can be. And rather than lose the Capitol, I'd say let's permit every school child in this state to go down to Juneau and visit the Capitol while the legislature's in session. Or let's pay the tab of free telephone communications to your legislators in Juneau while they're serving you. That's the way we could make government closer to people without hurting Alaskans, and of course still permitting us to address ourselves to our first priorities, education, healthcare, transportation, communication, environment, all of that. Next question, please.
Hello?
I can hear you.
Yes. A couple questions here for you.
Go ahead.
One, you endorsed the National Peace Action Coalition and also the People's Peace Treaty, which was written in Hanoi. Was there any particular reason why you did that?
Well, I don't know where you get the information that the peace treaty was written in Hanoi. I read that document very closely, and the only thing I could see in that document that there was a lot of love of fellow man,
uh-huh.
and that there was a deep desire for peace. Now, if you quarrel with that kind of a document, then that's your prerogative. We have a basic disagreement in the way human beings should act, and let's rest on that disagreement.
Another thing, on the People's Party down in Texas, you were a guest speaker there, right?
Yes.
And they call for the nationalization of all private property, legalization of drugs, including heroin, free abortion, and federal daycare centers. And you were the guest speaker there, huh?
Yeah, and I was booed at the time when I was there because a lot of the views that I put forward, they didn't like. So I think it's very important that a public official should make himself available to everybody who may want to ask him questions. And I think it's important for a public official to also expound views that he has. That's why I wrote a book, so that you can be informed as to the way I think, so you can make a better judgment as to whether or not you want me to be your senator.
Oh, I know that.
Good.
What I want to know is, if they disagreed with you, they asked you to be their nominee at the People's Party down in Texas.
Well, I don't think that they knew that to what degree they disagreed with me when they invited me to speak.
I'll bet. Also, on this National Peace Action Coalition, tried to shut down the government in Washington in May of about 2-3 years ago. You were an endorser of that, too, and... Oh, there was a bunch of flag burners. They drug the flags down the street, desecrated in every way known, and yet you endorsed it.
Obviously, certainly you're not going to paint it that I endorse flag burning. That's ridiculous. I love this flag just as much as you do. And I would not condone by any stretch of the imagination any American or anybody burning the American flag. So don't try and sell that and try and tag me with it. Now, I endorsed peaceful opposition to the war, and we'll continue to endorse it. Now, we made a mistake in getting into Vietnam. All I did was work hard to try and get us out of there, which is saving you your tax dollars.
Well, you thought 1968.
That's exactly wait a second, 1968?
Yeah.
You know what happened in 1968? Mm-hmm. I found out in 1971 that I didn't know as much as I thought I knew in 1968, and so I've changed. I hope that I'll continue to change, as I hope I'll continue to mature in office. Now, if you want to hold the fact that I changed my mind, that as I develop more information against me, then, boy, go ahead and hold it against me. Next question.
Hello?
Yes, I'm listening.
Is this Senator Gravel?
Yes, it is.
I'd like to ask a question, sir.
Please.
I'd like to know why in April of 1971, when the Alaskan Exchange System put out word that they were raising their prices due to the pay raise their employees were going to get, why we didn't get any pay raise and why we didn't get the cost of living allowance that civil service got in October of this year.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. I don't know the answer to your question, and I've got some staff people in the audience, and they're making a note of that question now. And if you'll just hang on to the line and give them your name and address, and I'll try to respond to you in writing, because I don't know why that did not happen, and I wasn't aware that it did happen.
Well, okay, I sure will.
Okay, so just hang on the line and give the gentleman your name and address. Okay, thank you. Next question. Please.
Okay. I do have one question. It's rather obvious, but Alaska cannot possibly supply the labor that's going to be needed to build the pipeline. And it is my idea that when the pipeline's through, there's going to be a huge labor pool of persons who are unemployed and who are now Alaska residents. Is there being any provision made to possibly forestall the possibility of thousands upon thousands of people being out of work in Alaska?
Not in specific plan to provide activities to address themselves to that. The pipeline construction will last for about 3 years. I fully anticipate that right after the pipeline is completed, we'll be going right on with the construction of an Alaska gas line. That in itself would absorb, a good deal of the slack in the down the deflationary aspects that will take place as this tremendous project will take place. I think it's going to be an economic problem. I think a lot of the Alaska business community should understand that and plan for that. I think a lot of businessmen can get geared up, but realize that as it's coming to an end, to gear down your inventories, to gear down slowly and not radically and put a lot of people unemployed. I think the business community is intelligent enough to anticipate that and handle it. But I think the economic activity as a result of energy is going to be of longer duration than we can appreciate. One of the things that will obviously sop up some of the economic activity will be the construction of the two federal buildings that will be built, one in Anchorage and one in Fairbanks, that I was able to secure. That will be a little longer duration. That'll pick up the slack for a year or so. I would hope that by that time we could have Devil's Canyon approved, if the economics are there, and I'm on the subcommittee that would bring that about. And if the economics are there, we could begin construction on a several billion dollar hydro project at that time to, again, pick up the deflationary aspects and pick up the unemployment that could take place. So there are a lot of things that we can do, and I think it's incumbent upon us as elected officials with responsibility for these things to plan ahead to meet the problem as it will occur. And as you point out, it will occur. Next question. Please. I can't hear you.
This is Senator Trump. Senator?
Yes?
I think that you are doing a great job. I think that you are doing a great job. And I hope that you succeed and keep pushing. And God is going to bless you. And God is on your side. So am I. And don't you forget it.
Thank you very, very much.
From the bottom of my heart.
Just hold it, Carl. Thank you very, very much. I
do sincerely hope that you go further than a senator. I do wish that you go for president. That's how much I have faith in you. I mean it.
Thank you very much. I think I've got some of the higher ambitions a little bit out of my blood. But I can tell you that I've been blessed already, blessed a great deal, because I enjoy public service. And I think it's one of the highest honors that a person can have in the whole world, to represent other people, and obviously in the Senate of the United States, to be a member of the Board of Directors of one of the greatest nations in the world. Is what you can't get a higher honor than that. And obviously, this year I'm asking to be bestowed that honor again, because I enjoy working for you. And again, let me thank you for your very kind words. Thank you.
Senator Gillette?
Please.
Yes, as long as you can tell me how you stand on national health insurance.
There are about, how many bills? Or at least 20 bills in the Congress. So when you talk in terms of national health insurance, you know, it's which bill? I don't know. Let me just define where we're at. I doubt that we'll see a bill come out of the Congress this year. It will come out of, incidentally, the Finance Committee, on which I serve, not the Interior Committee. I have already had amendments placed on most of the key health bills, the Nixon bill and the Kennedy bill, that were mental health. Because I think if we do come out with some legislation, we want to make sure that it covers everybody and not just try and do part of the job. I can assure you, and I see the time is running out, that the type of health program I will support will be one that will be cognizant of the private sector and not let government do it all, but to interface the situation so that we guarantee that everybody does get a decent health. I notice that our time is up. I want to thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for letting me come in your living rooms, for calling in and participating, making me accountable to you, because you're the boss. If this type of program is pleasing to you as a way of presenting myself to you, we'll hear your views. Call us at the office. I have an office in the federal building in Anchorage and an office in the federal building in Fairbanks. Stop by, call us, let us know your views, and if you want it, we'll come back on again and come into your living rooms and make ourselves accessible to you and accountable to you. You're the boss.
For the past hour, you have been participating in a live, unrehearsed, open line
That's
to
microbell. That's a bunch of goddamn bullshit.
The program was presented an opportunity to question your United States...